Sweat here, Tom Manti, representing SALT. I think it's a good idea at this point to talk about the general purpose of attorney's liens and its effect on the particular facts of this case. Mr. Phillips came to me through a patent attorney in 1996, yes, over 15 years ago. At that time, he had three patents, all of which had lapsed. He had not paid maintenance fees on them, therefore they were unenforceable. He had no money, he couldn't pay any costs, he had no evidence of any infringement by anyone, and if there was any infringement, the damages were not known. I eventually recruited four other lawyers to help me in this case, including the patent lawyer that I mentioned. And I bring this up because I think it goes to the whole purpose of attorney's liens. I think the purpose of attorney's liens is to ensure that people like Mr. Phillips, who have no money, but have a meritorious claim, as it proved, he gets $2.5 million out of this case. He had a meritorious claim. No one in their right mind would have taken this case, but for the attorney's lien, the charging lien statute. And this was stated by your predecessors.
Mr. Manti, I'm going to interrupt you. The policy is established by the legislature, and in that regard, we are bound by that policy. So the wisdom of the attorney's liens is already determined.
That's correct. And just briefly, I'll mention Miller v. Houston from 1915, it's cited in the brief, talks about why this legislature passed the bill that they passed. Now, as to the claim against AWH, AWH actually is a parent company of several other subsidiaries. I think that the issue there rests upon the facts. What are the facts that connect AWH to our state? What did they do to subject themselves to the jurisdiction of our state? And I state these in my reply brief, but I think it's worth re-mentioning them because they really never were discussed or rebutted by AWH. All of the patented wall panels that were the subject of the patent infringement case were developed in Colorado by a man who lived here and his corporation. They, that is AWH and their personnel, came to Colorado to court Mr. Phillips because they had heard about him through an intermediary. And they had persuaded him to enter into negotiations to form a contract to co-develop these panels for commercial use to build prisons. In the course of that negotiation, Mr. Phillips went to Virginia and people from AWH came to Colorado. The contract was eventually negotiated. It was signed by AWH in Virginia and by Mr. Phillips in Colorado. And significantly, the contract, which is an exhibit that has been submitted to the trial court, requires that Mr. Phillips and his corporation Secure co-develop, work on the plans to develop these panels in Colorado. And for 2 years, it's alleged without any rebuttal in the pleadings, for 2 years, there was nearly constant telephone, fax, and personal communication between Mr. Phillips and people from AWH.
Mr. Manti, now, if this were a litigation about that contract, I think that your argument brings us very close to a personam jurisdiction based on that contract. But this is not a litigation based on, that's not the issue here, is not that contract or whether that contract was breached. I think the issue here is whether AWH had any obligations based on your lien. How do the two connect?
As the Keith case and other cases say, the issue is whether or not the claim of the case arises out of the contact that was instigated by the subject defendant. And I don't think there's any doubt, and the pleadings are absolutely clear on this and unrebutted, that the contract led to the development of the panels. The panels then were made by AWH after the contract expired or lapsed, which caused the infringement. The infringement was the subject of the patent infringement lawsuit, which ran for 10 years in the federal court here in Colorado. I represented Mr. Phillips for almost all of those 10 years, except for the last few months. Therefore, the attorney's lien, which attaches by Colorado law immediately as to the client, as to the plaintiff, and by notice, to everyone else. A notice in the pleadings, you'll see the notice was filed, notice of lien was filed on 12/23/05, a year before the settlement in this case. And plus there was actual knowledge. I mean, I deposed, I did 36 depositions of, I would say, 24 personnel from Hopeman. I mean, they knew who I was, and furthermore, they knew Mr. Phillips was impecunious, and that he was not paying, and I was relying on whatever I got out of the case to pay me. So they had actual knowledge. One of the cases that
they had actual knowledge, certainly, that you were representing. Did they have actual knowledge that you had filed a lien?
Well, they did on December 23rd, 2005.
You served them with that notice?
They were served in the federal court. It was filed in federal court.
Okay.
There's one of the cases I cite, which, you know, brings up somewhat similar fact situation. It's not about an attorney's lien, but it's the Getman case cited on page 21 of my reply brief versus the North Valley Fork Restaurant. And in that case, the actual plaintiff was the widow of the decedent who had been killed in a car crash by an employee of the defendant. I bring that up because I think it's a similar situation where my lien, of course, was riding on the back of Mr. Phillips. I mean, my lien attached to him, and therefore, by notice, attached to Hopeman.
But here, you didn't inherit Mr. Phillips' claim. I mean, this is not really, I guess I question whether this dispute arises out of the contract between Mr. Phillips and AWH. Doesn't this really arise out of the contract between you and Mr. Phillips?
Well, I think that one rises out of the other. I think that, you know, certainly their contract with Colorado rises out of Mr. Phillips's contract, but I think once they get into litigation, once they start making the panels and infringe the patent, therefore it implicates Mr. Phillips and his legal counsel, which by Colorado law and law everywhere involves attorney's liens. Therefore, I think that, you know, the issue is, did they put themselves into the case and cause consequential damages that were foreseeable to Colorado residents, not a particular resident? And so I think that it's clear that they could foresee a damage not only to Mr. Phillips, but to his attorney, who had to represent him to go to court and spend 10 years, $74,000 in costs and $5,500 of attorney work.
And is the Getman case your most analogous case?
I think so, okay. Because you've got somebody who had obviously no contact herself with the defendant company, but her decedent husband did. He was the rider in the car that rolled over and he died. You know, because of the length of time here, I don't want to spend it all on AWH. I mean, there's other facts we cited in the brief. On the Dwayne Morris claim, I would point out that I think that the In Re Marriage of Smith case is very important here, in that that's a case where the lien was filed by the wife's attorney for $8,000. And the court ordered, subsequent to the lien being filed, ordered that the husband pay the wife as part of the settlement the $8,000. And he had already done so before there was any action on the lien. And the court said it didn't matter that the money had left his hands, that it was still subject to the lien. And that's kind of the argument I think that Dwayne Morris is making.
Counsel, would you address your colleague's argument here that as a matter of law, your fee is capped at $825,000?
I think that's incorrect. I think I made a settlement not only with Mr. Phillips, but also with HKH, which is a law firm, for another $25,000. I settled with 2 out of 4. And it's clear in the settlement document that this does not, is not affect anybody else. And in fact, the mediation agreement that we signed says this cannot be used as evidence by anybody except for me and Mr. Phillips.
But even if that's so, is your 45% contingency fee covered by what's in the Federal Registry?
No, it is not. There are two claims to the money in the Federal Registry, mine and the lawyers who followed me, which I will abbreviate by saying LGPs, Lowellville, Grubman and Payne. They have now have a judgment for over $1 million. I have the claim by Phillips's agreement for $825,000. That's about $1.9 million. There's $1.2, a little bit more, sitting in the court registry. All that Magistrate Judge Schaefer did was he just preserved some of the money. He was never asked to rule this money is affected by the liens, that money, and I like to use the terms blue and red. This is blue money that's encumbered by the liens, and this is red money that you can spend and it's free. I think that's a phony concept. I think all he did was say, okay, Mr. Manthei, you're asking me to put some money aside, and this is how much money I'm deciding. There was never any evidence about the value of the liens or anything. It was just an argument. And he put the money aside and says, that's all I'm going to do. I'm just going to preserve that, so at least you have this. He never ruled, you do not have access to the other money.
Who has the first lien, and won't that person...
I have the first lien.
And under the law, don't you then have the first priority to that money?
I certainly hope you're right, and I just made that argument to Judge Daniel, and I hope he believes it. I've got to reserve some time, so if it's all right with you, I'll sit down.
May it please the court, my name is Jared Bryant, attorney registration number 35773. I'm here on behalf of the Appalese AWH Corp, Hope and Brothers Inc., and Lofton Corp. And I plan to address briefly the personal jurisdiction issues in this case, and I've agreed to split time with the Appalee Dwayne Morris and will endeavor to allow them sufficient time. With respect to the personal jurisdiction issues, the trial court got it right. There's no dispute here that general jurisdiction is not an issue. Mr. Manthei admits as much in his reply brief at page 11. Likewise, there's no specific jurisdiction here because Mr. Manthei has not alleged a single contact with this state out of which his claim against AWH arises. So let's look at what Mr. Manthei alleges his claim arises from. First, Mr. Manthei alleges his claim arises from this 1989 contract between AWH and Edward Phillips. Well, we know it can't be that, because Mr. Manthei's present claim for recovery of attorney's fees is not a claim for breach of contract. And in fact, Mr. Phillips terminated the 1989 contract by the end of 1990, more than 18 years before Mr. Manthei filed the present case. Mr. Manthei was not named in that contract. Mr. Manthei was not a third-party beneficiary of that contract. In fact, Mr. Manthei didn't even represent Mr. Phillips in connection with that contract. The record reveals Mr. Manthei was never engaged by Mr. Phillips until 1996, more than 5 years after Mr. Phillips had terminated the 1989 contract.
But he was retained with regard to an alleged infringement that violated the contract?
Actually, the patent case that was filed by Mr. Manthei in 1997 was a case for patent infringement. It was not a case for breach of contract. So a separate issue from...
And the patent infringement did not also breach the contract?
There was no allegation that the patent infringement breached the contract. And in fact, I believe any claim for breach of contract would have been barred by the statute of limitations before filing of that case. So the bottom line here with respect to the 1989 contract is that Mr. Manthei's present claim for fees is wholly unrelated to AWH's contract with a separate Colorado resident, which existed more than 20 years ago. And in fact, Mr. Manthei has not identified any case supporting his effort to stretch the 20-year-old contract into jurisdiction over AWH for all purposes, for all claims. So second, we know that Mr. Manthei's claim can arise out of AWH's defense of the patent suit, because his claim for attorney's fees is a claim with his former client. It's a claim that his former client failed to pay the attorney's fees that he's owed. That is not a claim that arises out of simply defending a case brought against it by Mr. Phillips.
And if you ask you this, Mr. Bryant, so the defendant is brought in properly with personam jurisdiction and into the case in the Colorado federal court. And in that case, then, a lien is filed with regard to any judgment in that case. And when AWH now, let's say that they have a judgment to pay, are they not bound by the Colorado statute and to honor the lien?
Well, first, Your Honor, there was no judgment against AWH in the case.
Well, I know that, but and so I'm in this hypothetical, would they not be obligated if there had been a judgment?
Well, I don't think that there's an exception to the personal jurisdiction rules for attorney's liens cases.
I'm not looking for an exception. I'm just wondering if there's an arising out of, here they are. They are appearing in Colorado. They are functioning in Colorado, and they're subject to Colorado laws. And they have a judgment against them under Colorado law, and there's a lien with regard to that judgment. Aren't they bound by that lien?
I think the only act out of which the attorney's lien claim may arise is a payment of funds. Here we had a settlement agreement, so we're talking about a payment of funds. In this case, and let me back up just for a minute, the actual act of defending the lawsuit can't really be called purposeful availment because it's an act by a third party. The laws, both under Burger King and Keefe, say we need to look at what AWH does to determine whether that's a purposeful availment or a significant contact. Here, Mr. Phillips asserted a claim against AWH, and AWH defended, didn't assert counterclaims, and ultimately prevailed. Now, setting that aside, the fact that defending the case is not a contact, we look at the payment of money. Money was paid from AWH, from AWH's lawyer's trust account in Washington, D.C., to Mr. Phillips' then counsel's trust account in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The money was never paid into Colorado, and it was paid pursuant to a settlement agreement with Mr. Phillips that was negotiated out of state, that was executed out of state, and performed out of state, and in fact, after payment of money, didn't have any continuing obligations. So again, I think we have to be careful not to confuse the merits with the jurisdictional issue. And here, there's no question that under New Frontier Media versus Freeman, this type of settlement agreement is not the type that would confer jurisdiction in Colorado over AWH.
So do I understand correctly that our decision, in your view, does not depend on whether AWH is bound by Colorado law with regard to that lien? Because that's not the issue. The issue is whether they can be held in Colorado courts. But if we, in fact, went to a court that had personam jurisdiction, they might well be bound by the Colorado statute, and they might well be liable under that Colorado statute.
Right. I think that's a question that goes to the merits. And I think that, again, this jurisdictional issue, which you need to address as a threshold issue first. And again, no exception to the jurisdictional requirements for attorney's liens. So with that, I just want to conclude that, I mean, the bottom line is that what Mr. Manthei is trying to do here is stretch a 1989 contract, a 20-year-old contract between AWH and a third party, into consent to jurisdiction for all time, for all purposes. And Mr. Manthei hasn't cited any cases in his brief that would support that effort, and because of that, the trial court's ruling should be affirmed with respect to jurisdiction. Thank you.
Stop.
May it please the court. I'm James Phillips, here on behalf of Dwayne Morris, defending the underlying case. Summary judgment was properly granted in favor of Dwayne Morris because Mr. Manthei asserted an excessive attorney's charging lien. Mr. Manthei claimed that his charging lien attached to the entire $2.5 million settlement that was obtained by Dwayne Morris for Mr. Phillips. Manthei's maximum claim at the time of the settlement was $1.2 million. The plain language of the Colorado Attorney's Charging Lien Statute, CRS 12-5-119, limits the scope of attorney's charging liens by its plain language. It states that the lawyer shall have a lien, quote, for any fees or balance of fees due or to become due from any client, end quote. It goes on to state that lien is, quote, for any fees or balance of fees due or to become due from any client. Pardon me, that lien is, quote, for the amount of his fees, end quote. This language is controlling here. It defines the scope of the attorney's lien and the amount to which that lien attaches. The language that Mr. Manthei relies on only pertains to the items or things to which that lien attaches. It doesn't have anything to do with the amount of attachment. Binding Colorado Supreme Court law is consistent with this interpretation. And in fact, it also limits the attorney's charging lien. Those cases are specifically People v. Mills, People v. Radinsky, and In re Estate of Benny. The Mills case is particularly instructive here. There, the attorney represented a client in an estate matter and obtained a recovery of about $4,000 for the client. The attorney performed $500 worth of legal services on that case. However, the attorney asserted a charging lien over the entire proceeds obtained in the estate matter because the lawyer claimed that he had done services for the client in other matters that exceeded that $4,000 recovery. The Colorado Supreme Court rejected the lawyer's claim, stating that the lawyer, quote, could not have asserted a valid charging lien on the entire $4,079.83, end quote. The Supreme Court further declared that the charging lien was limited to the amount of fees owed on the estate matter alone, which were just $500. Manthei's conduct here goes above and beyond what the lawyer did in Mills, because Mr. Manthei only represented Mr. Phillips in the patent infringement case. The only fees that Mr. Manthei was entitled to from Mr. Phillips were governed by his contingency fee contract, which were capped at the time of settlement at $1.2 million.
But counsel, I thought I heard him say just a few moments ago his concern, and he's asserting that the Federal Registry may not sufficiently cover his fees because there's a third party involved. Can you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. Whether or not those fees are sufficient to cover his lien at this point in time is irrelevant to whether or not his lien was excessive and invalid based on the claim that he was making. Moreover, Mr. Manthei, at the time in the federal district court, when that action was still in effect, Mr. Manthei moved the federal court to impound funds to cover all the disputed attorney's claims. The court issued two orders on Manthei's two motions, first directing that Mr. Phillips deposit into the registry any funds that he currently has from the settlement. At the time, that was about $890,000. In Manthei's second motion, the court ordered another $300,000 to be deposited into the court registry, determining that that was sufficient security for Mr. Manthei's and LGP's claims, both claims.
1.1 would be sufficient to cover both?
That was what the federal court determined.
This is before any actual amount of fees has been determined.
That's correct.
Okay.
The federal court determined, though, that that was sufficient security for the disputed claims out there between LGP and Manthei. On top of it, if Mr. Manthei's lien is in fact invalid, it doesn't matter how much money is in the federal court registry.
But it is at least theoretically possible that Mr. Manthei's attorney fees will be determined to be more than $825,000.
That's incorrect.
Okay.
The stipulated judgment entered by the Boulder District Court was, quote, in the total and final amount of $825,000, which, now here's the key language, includes and incorporates all attorney's fees, costs, and interest, end quote.
Was that for all four parties, all four defendants?
That was for all attorney's fees owed. Mr. Manthei doesn't have a claim for attorney's fees against anyone other than Ed Phillips. He doesn't have a claim for fees against Dwayne Morris. He never provided any legal services to Dwayne Morris. He had no contract with Dwayne Morris. He's only asserted a charging lien, and he's now claiming that this charging lien somehow expands his rights beyond his contract with Ed Phillips. There's no precedent establishing that. Mr. Manthei has certainly cited none.
I suppose and Judge Daniels decides that he's not entitled to the entire amount of the 825, and he divides it up between the Los Angeles firm and Mr. Manthei. Then where are we? If there are insufficient funds left in the Federal Registry to cover his $825,000.
If the funds are insufficient, it doesn't matter. Mr. Manthei's lien, which is the only basis to which he has a claim to those funds, if that lien is invalid, he has no claim to those funds in the federal court registry. He has no claim against Dwayne Morris. He's left with whatever he's been compensated for out of that fund.
So the difficulty I'm having is that you prevailed on summary judgment. Dwayne Morris did?
That's correct.
And what it sounds to me like is that there's a lot of factual issues here yet to be determined.
I don't think there are any factual issues left to be determined. It's undisputed that the maximum amount of Mr. Manthei's claim at any point in time was $1.2 million. He states this in his opening brief on page 35.
Counsel, does that include potential interest or not?
Interest isn't covered by the attorney's lien statute. The attorney's lien statute simply says that the lien covers any fees or balance of fees due. and the lien attaches at the time that the judgment or settlement is reached. So the lien is what the lien is at the time of judgment or settlement.
So
continue to grow.
Your view is that it never could cover interest?
No.
Okay. And is that point disputed or undisputed?
That is a disputed issue, but that is a legal question. And Mr. Mampa has cited no authority under which he can assert that the lien covered interest.
Right. So if you're correct, then the amount in dispute is $825,000, yet to be determined, but not more than $825,000.
Not more than $825,000, and at no time was it greater than $1.2 million.
And so then,
so his lien could not attach beyond what his maximum recovery was. Okay. Even at this time, Mr. Mantha is claiming that his lien is about $1.6 million, and he's still asserting a lien to $900,000 more than that. He's still asserting that his lien covers the entire $2.5 million settlement.
So the issue here then is, assuming the facts as you're presenting them are undisputed, that the as a matter of law, his maximum lien is $1.2 million, then your issue here is that the registry of the court has sufficient funds in it and Duane Morris has no claim against it. There's no viable claim against it.
Duane Morris has no claim to the funds in the federal court
registry. No. That Mr. Mantha has no viable claim against Duane Morris because his $1.2 million is available right now in the registry of the court.
That is not Duane Morris's position.
Okay.
Duane Morris understands that there was a chain. To explain some of the factual background on how that argument came about and why the district court ruled the way it did, the federal magistrate Judge Schaefer initially entered a minute order declaring that LGP, the Los Angeles firm, had no lien rights. And accordingly, at that point in time when that minute order came out, there were sufficient funds in the court registry to cover the maximum amount of Mr. Manthai's claim. However, Magistrate Judge Schaefer later issued revised his recommendation to the federal district court and stated that LGP had a valid lien claim as against Ed Phillips and no one else. Therefore, those funds were still encumbered by LGP's lien, and at that point in time, there were not sufficient funds to cover the maximum amount of claims disputed under the law.
And therefore, I carry me to the next step. So what you have here is Mr. Manthai files a lien. The defendants in that case, notwithstanding the personam jurisdiction issue, they're subject to that lien. Whatever they take out of the settlement, they're subject to that lien. The Judge Schaefer puts a certain amount, causes a certain amount of money to go into the registry. And if that money is not enough to cover, and then Mr. Manthai saying, well, we've got this red money and this blue money, and we don't know who's going to get what yet. How do we know at this point that there's no genuine issue of material fact that Duane Morris took too much?
There's no dispute of material fact. And I'm sorry, this is a complicated answer to your question, so bear with me while I answer it. There's no disputed issue of fact as to that, because under the law, the assertion of an excessive attorney's charging lien invalidates that lien. Mr. Manthai didn't dispute that before the trial court and has therefore waived that argument. It should also be pointed out.
So your first premise is there is no lien.
There is no lien.
Okay.
There is no lien. That's wiped out, and therefore, whatever Mr. Manthai recovers from the federal court registry is purely gratuitous. The other point to keep in mind here, and Duane Morris was paid. The issue there is Duane Morris was paid out of an undisputed portion of those proceeds. At the time of the settlement, there were two disputed claims. Mr. Manthai's claim of $1.2 million and LGP's claim. LGP's fee agreement, which was attached as Exhibit 17 to Duane Morris's motion for summary judgment, included a clause guaranteeing Mr. Phillips' 25% recovery in the patent case after payment of prior counsel, i.e. Mr. Manthei. So because those are the only two disputed claims, there was going to be 25% left over for Mr. Phillips. So $637,500 in funds were undisputed that Mr. Phillips could do whatever he wanted with. Dwayne Morris was ethically obligated to disperse those funds. This is under Colorado Rule of Professional Conduct 1.15 subsection C. The position that Mr. Manthei is advocating is in direct conflict with Dwayne Morris's ethical obligation to disperse undisputed proceeds that come into its possession. So therefore, Mr. Manthei's lien is invalid, and Dwayne Morris was entitled to receive compensation. Sorry for the long-winded explanation, but it was necessary.
Thank you.
I've never quite understood the excessive lien argument, I have to admit. I filed a lien asking for reasonable compensation based on the quantum merit section of my contingency fee contract. I don't know how asking for reasonable compensation up to the cap of the 45% plus costs can be excessive. So I just don't get that. The next point I'd like to make before I lose my time is the whole issue of what Magistrate Judge Schaefer did with putting money into the registry and the settlement with Phillips are not undisputed facts. They were never alleged in the way that the trial judge asked us to do by numbering allegations in response to. It was never alleged that Judge Schaefer decided that $1.2 million was sufficient to pay both liens, and that's certainly not the case. Furthermore, the Phillips settlement didn't occur until the motion for summary judgment had already been filed by Dwayne Morris. So it was not an issue that was ever alleged or ever agreed upon. It's never been litigated as to what effect that settlement has, if any. And I would just cite one case because I didn't brief this because I don't think it was an issue. And that's the case of Neves, N-E-V-E-S versus Potter, 769 P. 2nd, 1047, a Colorado Supreme Court case, which talks about third parties trying to enforce agreements for releases in cases. And I'll give you a short quote from it. And it talks about the fact that there's an exception to the parole evidence rule. You have to have a hearing in which parole evidence is admitted as to what the intent of the parties was as far as some third party like Dwayne Morris. And it says that this exception to the parole evidence rule accurately reflects Colorado's unsympathetic position toward parties who seek to take gratuitous advantage of an agreement when they are not parties to the agreement. The agreement, the mediation agreement, clearly states it's only between me and Mr. Phillips. And it says that in the preamble, and on the last section, section 6, it says the mediation agreement shall not be admissible in any case other than a case between the parties to the mediation agreement to enforce its terms.
Counsel, how do you respond to the observation that, of course, the attorney fee arrangement is only between you and Mr. Phillips? There is no claim for attorney fees against anybody else. So why isn't the legal consequence of that settlement necessarily that you're capped at 825?
Because my claim is to enforce my attorney's lien. My attorney's lien by Colorado law, and I'll cite a couple of cases that are in my brief, North Valley Bank and Trevino versus HHL Financial. My attorney's lien is, and also the Smith case, is against anyone who has that money and has the notice. In this case, there is no dispute that they had the notice and they had all the money. And therefore, my claim is against anyone who had that money, just like the man in the Smith marriage case, like the husband. Even though he spent the money, he'd sent the money to the wife, he was still responsible for it. And the bid case is similar. So in this case, my claim was against four defendants. It was against Mr. Phillips. It was against HKH, which was the local Denver firm that I settled with. It was against AWH, who originally had the money and sent it to the lawyers for Mr. Phillips, and against Dwayne Morris, who had all the money. Therefore, settlement with Mr. Phillips was just that. It was settlement with one of four parties, and the settlement with HKH was just that. I settled with two out of four. fully understanding that I had claims against the others. And I would add parenthetically that LGP in its settlement also, some with Phillips, said, you've got this judgment and you can get the money wherever you can get it. In other words, everybody understood that you can get it against anybody against whom the lien is effective. And I would...
Mr. Manti, let me interrupt you. So are you arguing that to the extent there is any cap on your claim for fees against Mr. Phillips, that that Dwayne Morris has no standing to claim a limit? I mean, what I'm hearing you say is it's between you and Wayne Morris and the court as to how much you're entitled to. And for Dwayne Morris to come in and now say, well, in our view, Mr. Phillips doesn't owe anything more than X, that they can't make that argument, well, because they're not a party to that agreement.
As Your Honor well knows, anybody can make any argument in any court at any time. And I fully expect, if this case is remanded back to the trial court, that they will in fact make that argument that they're entitled to some relief from my agreement with Mr. Phillips. But that hasn't been litigated.
But you're saying that in your view, the argument that they're making here today, that your claim is invalid.
Yes.
Because it's excessive, that they can't make that argument, they can't prevail on that argument because that's between you and Mr. Phillips, and Dwayne Morris has no ability to raise that argument. Is that what you're saying?
I think we're getting two things confused here. I mean, one is their claim of excessive lien came way before I made any deal with Phillips. And that just had to do with their claim that I said that my lien attached to the whole settlement, even though the amount of my claim is what I said in my notice, which is what the contract says, quantum merit up to the cap of 45% plus.
It's certainly less than the entire amount, somewhat.
Certainly, yes. But I do think, in response to some of the colloquy that you had with counsel, that I do think the interest statute applies, but that's not before this panel. I think that'll be argued later. I think 512.102 clearly says that wrongfully withheld money is subject to interest, whether it's an attorney's lien trying to be enforced or it's a contract or a tort or whatever it is. Actually, tort has its own separate statute. But at any rate, that's not before your court, this court. One other point I'd like to make, if I have...
Yes, please do.
Is kind of looking forward to kind of the effect of what your ruling might be. Generally, not just on me, but otherwise, I think, you know, first of all, to say that, gee, just because you were the lawyer in the case that arose out of our contact with a Colorado resident, I think that really has a chilling effect, that an out-of-state defendant can come in and say, oh, look, you know, we never met your lawyer before the case began, and therefore we have no obligation to him under Colorado law and under the charging lien statute. I think that just totally defeats and emasculates the attorney charging lien statute as to the out-of-state defendant. Because, of course, they're never ever going to meet the lawyer. They're always going to meet the litigant, and then the lawyer comes later. And so,
but of course, Mr. Manti, the question here is, as they're saying, is personam jurisdiction, and why can't you just go to a court that has personam jurisdiction and tell them that Colorado law applies and enforce Colorado law in that other jurisdiction?
Well, once again, we're talking about a chilling effect.
Okay.
So you're saying to me, yeah, I have to go find these guys wherever they are, this Virginia in this case, and do litigation there, which is a huge burden on me to do that. And it's been a huge burden on me just to be litigating this for we're now toward the end of year five since the money showed up. And the second kind of looking forward as to the Dwayne Morris claim is that, you know, if you say that kind of once the money leaves your hands, that you no longer have any obligation, I think that defeats the whole purpose of the attorney's lien. I think the attorney's lien, as the case of North Valley Bank says, is the first lien has to be paid before anybody else gets paid. That's what Trevino also says. And I think the reason for that is to ensure that these people like Mr. Phillips are going to get counsel and that the money is paid right off the top. To say that, you know, we're sending the money down the road and we're no longer responsible defeats the whole purpose as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This case now has been argued. Thank you for your arguments, counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course. This